David Mark Wallis is Professor of Philosophy at the University of Southern California, specialising in philosophy of physics. He is the author of The Emergent Multiverse, Quantum Theory According to the Everett Interpretation, published in 2012 by Oxford University Press. He has a PhD in physics and a PhD in philosophy, both from the University of Oxford, where he previously served as Professor of Philosophy of Physics. David, please give us your interpretation of realism and anti-realism in science.
So I think Bastian Frasen's way of putting it is probably clearest, that realism is the position that what it is to accept a scientific theory is to believe that theory is true, and that what a scientific theory is an attempt to make claims about the world. In other words, the content of the theory is supposed to be, here are some statements which purport to be true about the world, and what you're doing as a scientist, according to realism, is you're accepting those statements as true. In reality, no scientist is ever going to want to do more than sort of approximately and tentatively accept a theory, but nonetheless, the act of unconditionally accepting a theory is just to think it's true. So there's two components there, and two sort of places you can get off the bus in the conventional dispute about realism and anti-realism. So the first thing you might say is that's not what a scientific theory is in the first place, and that's what the logical positivists and logical empiricists and instrumentalists of the first half of the 20th century basically thought. On their line, they would say, look, a theory is not to be understood as a collection of claims about the world, true or otherwise. A theory is a certain sort of tool or device which is supposed to help us make various kind of predictions about the relatively accessible, i.e., you know, what maybe that means what I can actually see with the naked eye, maybe it means what I can describe in the sort of language of ordinary language, ordinary use. But either way, that kind of anti-realism is going to be committed to saying something like, when a physicist says, this is a beam of electrons, electrons are really small particles, that's not meant to be taken literally. It's meant to say that thinking about the beam as a collection of small particles is a useful way to predict what we'll see on the screen at the end of the experiment. So that's the first kind of way you can get off the realist boat. The other way, which is, as it happens, what Van Frasen advocated, would be to say, yeah, the content of a scientific theory is a bunch of claims that purport to be about the world, but you can accept a scientific theory without believing those claims. So on that position, you're still using the theory as only really a tool to organise predictions, but to understand what the theory is saying, you have to understand it as making claims about the world, even though your attitude to those claims is rather more cautious than the standard realist attitude.
In those distinctions that you made, the two, can you interweave semantic realism and epistemic optimism? Some of the issues you were stating there could be covered by something like semantic theory.
If you use that terminology, then yes. So realism on Van Frasen's construction has a semantic and epistemic component. The semantic realist position is that to understand a theory is to understand it as making substantive claims about the world. And the epistemic component of realism is you should believe those claims. So the logical positivist, logical empiricist, the instrumentalist denies semantic realism. They have a construal of a theory as something that's not in the business of making claims about the world at all, or not about observable world. The epistemic realist agrees, so the epistemic anti-realist agrees with the realist about how to understand the theory. They just have a different epistemic attitude to the theory. I mean, you can analogize this really to some of the philosophical disputes in the early modern period. I mean, in that sense, the sort of scepticism that Hume or Descartes are exploring is an epistemic scepticism. It's a view that our claims about the real world, they say what they appear to say. If I say there is an external world, or my memories are veridical, I really am saying what I appear to be saying. But the skeptic in that sense is just saying, yeah, but don't believe those claims. We don't have good grounds to think those claims are true. The Berkeleyan idealist is it's slightly anachronistic to call that a semantic anti-realism, but the same kind of style. The Berkeleyan anti-realist is saying, well, there's apparent claims that there is an external world, that I have something in my hand. Those claims are true, but they don't mean what you think they mean. I'm not literally saying I'm holding a pencil in my hand now. When I make that claim, I'm saying something about, you know, the idea in the mind of God is such that it appears to me that there's a pencil in my hand, or something like that. So in some ways, you're seeing those kind of issues, which are about various sorts of scepticism about the world writ large, played out in scientific realism and anti-realism in the narrower corner of the specific claims about the unobservable parts of the world that our best scientific theories seem to make.
And as a variation to that, you could possibly add the Kantian idea that there is an external world, but obviously we can't directly access it. It's constructed mentally from us, and we put theories onto the world.
Yeah, although, I mean, yeah, there's as many ways of reading Kant as there are people who've read Kant. But yeah, at least something along those Yemen lines seems to get at the sort of thing he's after.
One aspect that became even more contentious after the Scientific Image and Bas van Frassen is this idea, because what have you been saying so far? I just wanted to know how you thought it tied in with the observable, unobservable divide. So, you know, traditional strict science in a very small, narrow defined sense is something we can only talk about instances that we observe in the world, and these observations must match theory, and obviously that's how we predict it through experimentation. Of course, in actual labs around the world for the last few decades, no one's directly or ever observed a quark or the Higgs boson, but we've observed it indirectly, so that's push the agenda aside. So answer that when you can as well, David. And also, secondly, empiricists, though, in terms of you can have many theories that match onto some kind of empirical fact about the world. At what point do you draw the line there in terms of aspects of undetermination of theory by evidence? So if you can address those two points.
So one of the basic things that you need to be able to do to make some kind of semantic anti-realism fly is to draw some kind of distinction in language between those claims that we really are supposed to believe are true, and those claims that, or the least that we're supposed to understand as trying to be true, and those claims that we're not really supposed to understand as trying to be true at all. So maybe the claims that I take at face value are just claims about my sensory experiences, or maybe they're claims about sort of medium-sized objects. But there has to be some division of that kind, because the whole idea of this kind of framework is that the statements I don't take literally are indirectly to be understood as tools for understanding and organizing the statements I do take literally. So there aren't any statements at all that I'm supposed to be taking literally. I just don't have a starting point to get that framework off the ground. And one way to see what just caused that program in philosophy of science and philosophy generally, which was very dominant for many decades, kind of to come off the rails gradually by the middle of the last century, was an increasing feeling it just wasn't possible to draw those distinctions in language. So, you know, one of the basic themes of Quine's Two Dogmas of Empiricism, which is one of the sort of seminal papers that brought down that kind of edifice of logical positivism, is that if you try to, well, firstly, if you try to make that distinction, if you try to say how it is that any given sentence in the non-literal bit of our language is supposed to be understood in terms of what it says about the literal bits of the language, the whole thing just becomes ridiculously holistic. I mean, in my sketch earlier, I was saying what it means to say there are some electrons in this beam is something like, I will see such and such flicker on the screen. But the reality is that claim is only ever going to be true given a vast number of background assumptions, which are also stated in the language of the theory and not in the language of the directly observable. And so you're sort of led to the conclusion there's just no clean division to make here. And then the other side of that is that if you actually start trying to state and develop this supposed language which only uses sort of non-theoretical, directly observable concepts, it just starts coming apart. I mean, just everyday terms like microwave or laptop show this kind of thing. Those are terms which, when you really interrogate them, and ask, well, what makes it true that some physical object is a microwave? You're going to really struggle to answer that question except by using a lot of the terminology of science. And there's kind of no way out of that circle. So I think one of the things that drove the sort of second half of the 20th century's sort of near consensus on some kind of semantic realism is the idea that there just wasn't going to be a division of that kind to be made, that if we had to had to make sense of our theories, then making sense of our theories had to be about taking them as literal statements of what the world's like in some sense. I mean, there are ways in which more recent developments in structural realism say it's a bit more complicated than that, but at least as a starting point, that what a theory is in the business of doing is just telling us what the world's like, and we can't really divide it up and say some part of the theory is not in the business of telling us what the world's like, and the other bit is. And that's kind of why Van Frassen, when he's saying, okay, how can I have an anti-realism, how can I resist what he sees as sort of metaphysical excess of just accepting all of this sort of panoply of unobservable concepts as things I have to believe. What's driving him is the idea that we can make a distinction between the observable and unobservable at the level of epistemology, even if we can't make it at the level of language. So Van Frassen wants to say, all of your language is theory-laden, but your language is still in the business of referring to objects. And for some of those objects, you can say, yeah, I can see that object with the naked eye, and some objects you can't. So, you know, paradigmatically, I'm seeing my laptop in front of me. So even though the way I've characterized my laptop is quite theory-driven, the fact that I can see my laptop with the naked eye is not in contention. And at the other end of the spectrum, it's not in contention that I can't see free quarks with the naked eye. So the idea in Van Vassen's framework there is I can principally divide things there are into observable things and unobservable things, but that distinction is at the level of epistemology rather than the level of language. And then that lets me have an anti-realism which is epistemic, which just doesn't believe or is agnostic about those claims that are claims about the unobservable objects, and only accepts as true those bits of the theory that are claims about observable objects. Now, the problem with that is that, I mean, it's far from uncontentious that even that division can be sharply drawn. I mean, use the example of Higgs boson. I mean, so what's the sense in which we didn't directly observe that? Well, of course, that observation is a sort of chain of inferences going up towards what people directly saw. But it's hard to see quite where the principled line in that chain of inferences is to be drawn. I mean, Van Frassen just bites the bullet and says it's literally about human sensory capabilities. So what can I see with my eyes and hear with my ears, or what can I and other people in my community hear with our ears and see with our eyes? And those are the things we should accept. And he just kind of basically says there's no sort of metaphysically deep distinction here, but we're not doing metaphysics, we're doing epistemology. So sure, alien beings with different sensory capabilities would have a different epistemology, but it's not a problem for our epistemology to be addressed to our capabilities. And I think one way to get a grip on that, on why that's not a crazy thing to think, I don't think it's correct, but it's not crazy, is that I don't think Van Frassen is in any way saying this is compulsory or you have to accept this position. What he's saying is just here is a coherent alternative position you could adopt. And his grounds for doing that, I think, are just basic Humean skepticism. He doesn't think that we're actually justified in even believing those things our theories say about the observable world. Because he thinks the lesson we get from Hume is we're just not justified in accepting any of these claims at all. But, you know, you've got to get by. I mean, that's a way of considering what Hume is saying. I mean, no, you have no justification in believing any of your beliefs about the future and things. But what else are you going to do? Hide under the covers? So Van Frassen, I take Van Frassen as sort of saying, well, given we have no justification for anything at all, nonetheless, we've got to get by. But let's not get by with more leaps of faith than we have to. And here's a halfway principled way of sort of stopping our leap of faith.
The observables empirically may stay the same. The theories that accompany that might be different. Obviously, that kind of ties into the pessimistic meta-induction.
I think it's a matter of hot contention whether the theoretical content of theories really does enjoy that kind of radical change. But there's at least a worry that it does.
Now, structural realism, it can help explain the shift. You're saying it still can be a contentious issue, perhaps not as grave as, say, the paradigm shift in Thomas Kuhn. But the observables, to a certain extent, remain the same. But the theory that accompanies this observed phenomena can change. To what extent, and there's a quite contentious issue, you claim, within that in a theory, but in terms of structural realism, it says that the theory on top of it can change, but there's an underlying structure, whether it's composed of empirical facts and observation or of mathematical instruments, that remains the same. So talk about structural realism in that respect, and also how it ties in to your realism.
So structural realism as a slogan kind of comes out of a very sort of insightful observation by John Worrall in, I think, the early 90s, which, as with most insightful observations, you can actually, in hindsight, you can spot the observation having been made earlier, and there were lines in Russell and Poincaré back in the start of the 20th century that prefigure those notions. Leaving aside the authorship, the observation is this, that there seems to be a great deal of continuity between older physical theories and newer physical theories, not just at the level of the observational claims, but of the mathematical and equational structure that we use to do the theories. So although there seems to be a very sharp discontinuity between the way Newtonian gravity describes the world, you know, a bunch of particles interacting by long-distance forces, and the way relativity, just general relativity, describes the world as a curvature of space-time brought about by the presence of matter, nonetheless, you can, and this is just the standard fare of upper-level undergraduate physics, you can just see how the equations of Newtonian mechanics come out as certain approximations to the equations of general relativity in certain regimes. And you see just the same in those other examples of apparent radical theory difference. So the insight, which falls short by itself of being a philosophical position, is that we ought to be looking for some kind of version of realism that thinks we should be realists about the structural claims of our theories and not simply the observational claims, because those structural claims do seem to be continuous across theory change, and those structural claims also seem to be doing the explanatory work, making sense of the observations, which is a lot of the reason why people take scientific realism seriously in the first place. But in trying to cash that instinct out, I mean, there have been sort of two ways of trying to make sense of it. James Lademan called this an epistemic structural realism and an ontological or ontic structural realism. I think perhaps metaphysical structural realism might have been in some ways a better name. And the idea of the epistemic structural realist is they basically accept that kind of Van Frassen style story that scientific theories are making claims about the world. Some of them are observational and some are non-observational, but among the non-observational claims they try to identify some structural claims. And the idea is supposed to be that once we've identified the claims in the theory that are the structural claims, then we should believe those claims, but not the non-structural, non-observational claims. I mean, you mentioned Kant earlier. There's a certain sense in which you can see Kantian humility as a sort of epistemic structural realism. So Kant says, I mean, for reasons that aren't quite the same as the modern structural realist, but Kant says it's not just that I have the observational stuff. I've also got some claims about how the unobservable world must be organized and structured, and I have reasonable grounds to accept that, but the things in themselves, what they are that are organized and structured that way, those are not things that I can't have access to or any way of having access to. Or at least that's one way of reading Kant. So that's the epistemic structural realist route. In other words, theories have structural features and non-structural features, and I should believe what the theories say about the structural features and not about the non-structural features. The problem with that has really been, how do you principally identify or separate off the structural features from the non-structural features in the theory? And it's sort of very hard to find a middle ground. I mean, most attempts to do it have either collapsed onto saying structural features as observational features, or you end up saying structural features are basically all features. And so in effect, you get, if you go the first way, then you're just back to empiricism and anti-realism. And if you go the second way, then you haven't really moved on from standard realism. So that makes the second sort of way of understanding structural realism, I think, more interesting. And that way of approaching it really says, well, actually, the right way to understand the content of a scientific theory is that it's entirely structural. So, I mean, if epistemic structural realism is trying to take a halfway house between epistemic realism and epistemic anti-realism, then ontic or metaphysical structural realism is trying to find a halfway house between semantic realism and semantic anti-realism. And it's very contentious how to cash that out, but at least the way I think gets at things best is to say something like the content of scientific theories, or at least of the sort of scientific theories that physicists use, is basically mathematical. I was saying in the beginning that the sort of way of cashing out standard realism is theories are in the business of making claims, making statements about the world. Those are inherently linguistic claims. So I think the metaphysical structural realist was going to say, well, look, a theory is not a thing in language at all. Of course, I can describe it in language, just like I can describe my house in language, but that doesn't mean my house is language. It doesn't mean the theory is language. What is the theory? The theory is a bunch of mathematics. It's basically a bunch of mathematical models. And from that point of view, what the structural realists are going to say on these lines is, well, my realism consists in the claim that my model faithfully represents some features of the world. In other words, the world is structured as my model is. But they're not going to want to construe the theory as making the sort of claims that you can make in language, except as a second order derivative, almost sort of popular science level. And what that gets you is the idea that we're having a much coarser grained notion of theory. So as a rule, if you start with the theory's mathematics in the way you come across in a physics textbook, and then you try to imagine writing that down in language, let alone sort of formalizing it in a formal language in the way that philosophers often do, what you find is the linguistic classification of the theory is a much more finely grained description than the mathematical description. And you start having to make distinctions that the mathematics of the theory doesn't make. So, for instance, the mathematics of Newtonian gravity doesn't really care whether gravity is a force or a curvature of space-time. You can interpret the maths one way, you interpret another way, and you can have interesting discussions about what's most natural, but the maths itself doesn't tell you that that's how to think about it. You only get that construal of Newtonian gravity once you start putting a verbal gloss on the mathematics. So if the full content of the theory is mathematical, then you've got a continuity from Newtonian gravity to general relativity, to Einstein's gravity, that you just don't see if you've got the sort of more fine-grained individuation of theories that you get in standard realist way of thinking about theories.
Thanks for that, David. Kind of ties in quite neatly into the next aspect, which is reductionism. So what can be said about reductionism in relation to realism and anti-realism?
The issue of math versus physics is not quite the issue in play in reductionism, and that's really a question of what's the content of our theories. And that could apply for a higher level physical theory, like our theories of how fire burns in your fireplace or something, that's described mathematically in modern physics, just in the same way that particle physics or string theory is described mathematically. I think reduction is more a question of what's the relation that's supposed to hold between physical theories. So, I mean, here's a natural way in which you might say that one physical theory reduces to another. You might say something like, well, my higher level theory is in the business of modeling such and such phenomena, and it models them by certain mathematical structures, and my higher level theory is reducible to my lower level theory if I can derive the mathematical structure of my higher level theory from my lower level theory in some circumstances under certain approximations. And there's room to query how much this is true across the edifice of science as a whole. It's relatively uncontentious that it's true within bits of physics. So for instance, if you want to understand fluid dynamics, how water flows or something in terms of the microscopic constituents of water, we've got a pretty good grasp of the mathematics of the fluid at the atomic level. We've got a pretty good grasp of the mathematics of the fluid at the sort of phenomenal level. And we've got a pretty good grasp of how you can derive the second of those from the first and in what circumstances that derivation works. So that's the sort of local sense in which one theory might reduce to another theory. And then reductionism as a sort of bigger philosophical thesis would be something like that. There's one lowest level theory, and ultimately every theory we use sits somewhere in a chain of theory instantiations of this kind that eventually sort of grounds out at the lower level theory. So in contemporary physics, the standard model of particle physics looks a plausible candidate for being a reduction base for basically everything. So the progress of theoretical physics has generally been to annex together more and more domains within physics into a unified set of equations, so we actually do have this theory now that is at least a candidate for describing what goes on in the world in all circumstances. Now, of course, we only have in place pieces of that reductive theory. I mean, we know quite a lot, for instance, about how the physiology of respiration links to the biochemistry of respiration. We know quite a lot about how solid matter grounds out in atoms. We know quite a lot about why these gases expand into the space they're occupying. We know quite a lot about how biophysics constrains the motion of dinosaurs and elephants and things. Thousands and thousands and thousands of individual pieces like that in the jigsaw. That falls vastly short of being a systematic account right across the board of how ultimately everything reduces down to some lower level. And at some level, you want to say reductionism in that sense is a research program. The way to show it's wrong wouldn't be to advance some a priori argument why it must be wrong. It would be to keep pushing that program and eventually find somewhere where you just can't make it work. So at the turn of the 20th century, people thought that there was just no prospect of a reduction of living matter to non-living matter. And we now understand that stuff tolerably well, and by no means completely, but the paradoxes and mysteries and the roadblocks seem to have gone away, and we're just left with a very large number of specific problems.
Now, talking of and physics and realism, and you can talk about obviously the emergent multiverse. First of all, talk about the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics and the Everett principle, and why you endorse that, and what that says ontologically about the world, as in the wave function collapse really does exist, it isn't an instrumental tool, and your justifications behind that.
Sure. So the starting point here is the puzzles of making sense of quantum mechanics, and the problem in sort of non-mathematical terms is that if you try to take quantum mechanics seriously as a representational theory, as a theory describing the world, then the theory seems to say that, firstly, the theory seems to say that ordinary microscopic stuff like atoms and molecules can somehow be doing two things at once. So an electron can be here and there at the same time, or going this way and going that way at the same time. And that seems weird, but you might shrug and say, well, the microscopic world could be weird. There's no reason why the sort of linguistic structures we're used to at the everyday level make sense at the microscopic level. But the problem is that the theory also goes on and says that if you were to in any way magnify up microscopic effects at the macro level, in particular if you were to make a measurement of where a quantum mechanical particle is, suddenly that indefiniteness goes up to the macro level too. So it's not now just the electrons here and there at the same time. It's the needle on your measurement device that's here and there at the same time. I mean, to use Schrödinger's famous example, if you set things up so I make a measurement to where the electron is, and if I find that it's here, I kill my cat, and if I find not here, I don't kill my cat, then if the electron is here and here at the same, here and there at the same time, then after the measurement, the cat is alive and dead at the same time. And that just seems crazy. It doesn't seem that we can perhaps even make sense of a cat being alive and dead at the same time. But even if we could, it looks as if we don't see cats being alive and dead at the same time. So the theory is either incoherent or just falsified. So a reasonable starting point in solving that would be saying, okay, if you take that problem at face value, then your options seem to be, well, you could either drop the sort of scientific realism, my theory is representing the world assumption. In other words, you could change the philosophy away from the sort of semantic realism default starting point. Or you could change the physics. You could say, if the physics predicts this stuff, the physics is wrong. Let's change the equation somewhere. Call that the change the physics strategy. And both of those strategies are pretty profoundly difficult. The people who advocate changing the philosophy are mostly physicists who don't tend to realize or take seriously enough how good the philosophical arguments are for some kind of representational reading of a theory. And the people who advocate for changing the physics are mostly philosophers who, I think, simplifying rather, don't always appreciate just how thorough and developed the mathematical structure of quantum mechanics is and how difficult it is to modify it to solve this problem without breaking a lot of the results of the last 3/4 centuries of physics. You might think that there's sort of no alternative to do one of those or the other. Whatever observed is really, well, why can't the cat be alive and dead at the same time? And the obvious response is, well, we don't see cats being alive and dead at the same time. But I think what that actually means is something like, we have an intuition of what it would be like to see a cat being alive and dead at the same time. It would be something like being really drunk and seeing double. But you don't work out what it is to see something in physics for your intuition. You do it through the physics. What the physics says is, if I were to look at a cat that's alive and dead at the same time, I would at the same time be in a seeing live cat and seeing dead cat state. And if you were to ask me, is the cat alive or dead, then you would then be in a David says the cat is alive and David says the cat is dead state at the same time. And that kind of process just sort of ramifies up. So in pretty short order, the quantum mechanical description of the planet as a whole, the solar system as a whole, is going to be something like, the world is as it would be if the cat was alive, plus the world is as it would be if the cat is dead. And the mathematics of quantum theory tells you that those two chunks of physical reality don't really interact with each other. So we can treat them, for all practical purposes, at an sort of approximate emergent higher level way, we can treat them as two separate worlds, two separate lots of goings on. And the thing that's really important to get across here is, because that sounds pretty science fictional, to be honest, is that this isn't an idea that where somebody's saying, well, quantum mechanics is weird. You know what would make it even weirder? Adding some parallel universes to it. So let's put some parallel universes into the mix. That would be nonsense. That would be crazy. The idea is that if you just look at the mathematics of the theory and you think carefully about it, you realize that the theory all along was something that could be understood representationally. But what it was representing wasn't a single classical world, it was a whole bunch of classical worlds. And that's really the many worlds theory. It's kind of has a metaphysically crazy feel to it. It's actually, in many respects, very conservative. It's what you get if you hold on to the idea that our theories are just literally representing the way the world is, and also if you hold on to the idea that we shouldn't change our theory, that our theory is just fine as it is, thanks.
Okay, just to clarify one point there, David, if you could please. So, I'm not sure to what extent that actually solves the problem. So, as you were saying, we don't exist in a world in which there's both a dead cat and a live cat simultaneously. So why would, on top of that, be saying, well, that must be because there's two distinct worlds that exist independently, simultaneously? Isn't that just the same logic?
Well, as you say, we don't exist in a world where cats are alive and dead simultaneously. That's correct. But according to the theory, we don't exist in such a world. We exist, let's say, in the world where the cat's alive, and some people very much like us exist in the world where the cat's dead. And while we could have just known from experience that our neck of the woods in reality doesn't have simultaneously live dead cats, we don't have any kind of direct empirical reason not to think there aren't parallel worlds like ours with dead cats in.
So, to a certain extent, talking about parallel realities and parallel dimensions, your book is called The Emergent Multiverse. So before I get you to speak about that and how it ties in, obviously, to Schrödinger's Cat and the Many Worlds interpretation. So someone like Andre Linde, who's a big proponent of inflationary cosmology in terms of not the Alan Guth style, but inflationary cosmology in terms of there's consistency, in terms of big bangs are always happening and we get pocket universes and this is eternal and inflation precludes any universe to a certain extent, and that's why we have multiverses, and to a certain extent that solves the problem of fine-tuning, which a lot of people don't think fine-tuning is actually a problem itself. That's a separate issue. So that's one conceptual physical tool and mathematical model of the multiverse, and now I'm assuming you've got another argument in favour of that. So firstly, clarify anything that I may have misrepresented about the multiverse.
So the eternal inflation mechanism for producing multiple copies of the universe that Linde is considering is not the same as the quantum mechanical mechanism that I'm talking about here. So there's a reason my book's called The Emergent Multiverse. The universe, according to quantum mechanics, it doesn't have a fundamental branching structure. It has an emergent higher level branching structure at the level of microscopic physics. Linde's multiverse, you might call, the inflationary multiverse, you might call a fundamental multiverse. It's sort of multiverse at a much lower level in the theory. Now, of course, who knows what speculative physics will tell us about how those ideas are connected, but at least at face value, they're just two entirely different mechanisms that generate parallel universes.
Okay, yeah, thank you for that, David. My point essentially was that both your work and Linde's work fundamentally assert that there is an ontological, factual basis to multiverses.
Correct, yeah.
The multiverse is almost, I don't know how to what extent it's becoming a dominant paradigm in physics, but if you can, just run through some reasons. Obviously, you've highlighted your ones, which are from quantum mechanics, and there's Linde's, and also Vilenkin's done some work in this area. But what are the actual reasons for asserting a multiverse and how that ties into realism?
It's not that people have a general argument to say there ought to be a multiverse, here are some reasons for it. It's more that people say this particular bit of physics generates this particular kind of multiverse. So it's perfectly coherent to think that the Many Worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics is true, but that inflationary cosmology is wrong. And then you're led to think that we're living in a quantum mechanical multiverse, but that there aren't multiple Big Bangs going on. And it's equally coherent to think the opposite, and to think that Linde's right about the Big Bang structure, but that the Many Worlds theory of quantum mechanics isn't the right way to understand quantum mechanics, in which case we're living in a, you know, vast number of Big Bangs set up, but each of those Big Bangs is just one classical universe with no sort of quantum mechanical branching. I've said basically what the argument is for believing in the quantum mechanical multiverse. It's really just that it's the most conservative way to make sense of the quantum theory we have, without having to change the theory or change our way of understanding theories. The reasons for believing in the multiverse of something like eternal inflation, the short answer really is just that we have fairly good, but if not decisive grounds in cosmology to think that this inflation mechanism functions in the very, very early universe, and that it's necessary to understand various structural features of the observable universe. And the nature of that mechanism makes it really hard to turn off. So if you have it operating in our neck of the woods, it's very hard to prevent it keeping operating and just keeping sort of bubbling off universes. But to be truthful, if I wanted to go into more detail, it would be a bit above my pay grade. Inflationary cosmology is not something I'm particularly familiar with.
No, that's completely reasonable, David. But any other reasons why you think it's far more likely or reasonable that we live in a universe in which there's other universes, i.e. multiverses, as opposed to a monoverse, and whether that ties into a fine-tuning problem or not? So why is it that, from your perspective, that the fact that this is the only universe and we live in it isn't as likely as it being multiverse? You already use the quantum mechanics, but any other?
From my point of view, pretty much purely quantum mechanics. I think quantum mechanics gives us very strong reason to think that's true along Everett's lines. My assessment of the sort of inflationary cosmology arguments for multiple universes would really just be an assessment of third-party reliability of experts. I'm not on top of the material enough at first order to be able to assess whether those arguments are good. Those arguments are made by people who I take seriously, but they're also criticised by other people I take seriously. I don't feel in a strong position to assess it. I think we're very much in the realm of speculative ways physics could go, although I don't think it's an unreasonable set of speculations. Beyond that, I think the sort of a priori arguments that says we must live in a multiverse because that's the only way to explain fine-tuning, I don't think that would be a very good reason to posit parallel universes anymore. I think it would a good reason to posit a creator deity. I think it is plausible you can make sense sense of fine-tuning via a multiverse, but the way that argument would go would be something like, I already have excellent grounds to think there's a multiverse because of such and such argument in physics. Given that I think it's likely there's a multiverse anyway, fine-tuning can be explained in that framework.